So we love this new sermon series. For those of you who aren't part of our church, we've Rick's just started us on a new sermon series called Stories. And last week we were very inspired to hear the story of a group of people that went down to Mexico and have been doing this Mexico mission trip for the last many years. And we were really inspired by their story and reminded us what a great idea it is to tell stories in our own families and as a church family to be able to share the amazing things that are happening within our individual lives, but in our big life as a family together. So we kind of are going to work in reverse. This is going to be like one of those stories where you get to kind of skip to the end first. And what we're going to start with is just a whole review, a little music slideshow of our year. And then we're going to break it apart. And we're each going to tell you some highlight stories of our year. So please enjoy this little video. Sort of all the pictures in our storybook, not all of them, we had to whittle them down. What we're going to do is we would like to be able to just break down sort of where Stuart's going to start by giving you a brief history of Rwanda, which is where we were, and then we are going to hopefully be able to bring life to some of those images that you saw and tell you about our experience this year.
All right, let me lower this.
Debbie's a little taller than I am.
Now, the power of small. You may notice that I didn't watch the video. I'm shrimpy. You may notice I didn't watch the video. I showed the video to my staff at HD Stafford, and I thought it was going to be fine. And then I watched the video, and I totally lost it. I was like, I couldn't control myself, and I'm bawling like a complete fool in front of half the staff that didn't even know me. It's just awful. Thank you so much for the people that made an extra special effort to come here today to hear our story. It really means a lot. So you may notice that I'm wearing khakis. In May, I swore I would never wear them again. It's because in Rwanda, I had to dress like this every day, and I'm not super great with pants and shirts. I usually like to wear shorts and t-shirts, and it was hot. It was 30 to 33 during the days, and then you hit in the shade and cool down a little bit, and you'd come in the sun again, you'd overheat. So as testament, as a symbol to the commitment of our time in Rwanda, I am now wearing khakis and a nice shirt. Yeah? Okay. The administration at our school in Rwanda said that the staff, all the men, would have to start wearing ties. I almost got it on an airplane and came home. To understand our experience in Rwanda, I have to try and summarize what happened for 3 months in 1994. And it's clinical. I'm going to try to go through it so that it's clear. It can be a little convoluted. So, but it gives a really important picture of Rwanda and what makes it a unique and amazing country. So in 1994, Rwanda is made up mainly of two ethnic groups. 85% were Hutu and about 15% were Tutsi. Before the colonial era, the Tutsis were in the higher strata, the Hutus in the lower. People could move from strata to strata. You know, the Hutus could move up to the Tutsi level, Tutsis could move down to the Hutu level. So in the 50s, Germany, they lost possession of Rwanda, and Belgium took over. And the Hutu movement increased with the Tutsis fleeing the country. By 1962, 120,000 Tutsis had taken refuge in neighboring countries. And the conflict continued until 1980. Almost 500,000 Tutsis had become refugees in the surrounding countries of Rwanda. The Belgian government effectively took a race and divided them. And the old adage that if you can divide, you can conquer, was the reason why. So they even created IDs to identify Tutsi or Hutu. And there are small differences. You could tell the difference. But really, they were the same people. So in 1988, the RPF, which is the Rwandan Political Front, had formed in Uganda, composed mainly of Tutsis. In 1990, the RPF launched an attack of Rwanda from Uganda with a force of 7,000 fighters. And when that happened, the Hutus saw it as a great opportunity. Here we've got Tutsis that are attacking us. Let's make all the Tutsis bad guys. So they labeled all the Tutsis traitors. In April of 1994, the presidents of Burundi and Rwanda were coming home to Rwanda in an airplane, and there was a plane crash caused by rocket fire. And then at that point, the presidential guard started killing Tutsis. Roadblocks had been set up in 30 minutes in the country. They were taking Tutsis, identifying them, and they were pulling them aside. There was one radio station in the country controlled by the Hutus, and it was used to incite hatred and violence. It reduced Tutsis to the level of what they called cockroaches. So in 7th April, 10 Belgian soldiers were killed, and other moderate Hutu leaders were killed. On April 21st, Belgium withdrew, and following this, other countries withdrew. And the UN force reduced their troops from a little over 2,000 to less than 300 people in Rwanda. Non-Rwandans did remain, however, you've all heard of Romeo Dallaire, maybe, and they tried the best to communicate the dangers of what was happening in Rwanda to the rest of the world. And while in 1994 we were watching the trial of O.J. Simpson, remember that? With the white Bronco on the freeway? While that was happening, a million people were being killed. A million. It's the population of Vancouver Island. So, in 1994, the RPF took military control of Rwanda, and the genocide ended. And in 2000, 100,000 genocidaires were awaiting trial. And the UN tried to get a regular form of trial working, but it didn't. It just took too long. And the Rwandans did something quite amazing. It's called, the word is called gachacha, and it means courts in the grass, essentially. And what they did was they took the accused and put them in a circle surrounded by the accusers and the community that they had injured. And they had a chance to hear what the accusers had to say. And if they're fully, honestly repentant, the accused could participate in a form of reconciliation with the city. The genocide is woven into the fabric of Rwanda. Everyone is affected by it. We made great friends who gradually would, over time, they would relax and they would mention, you know, yeah, you're having a really hard day today. Yeah, today's the anniversary of when my family was killed. Or you'd hear just asides, like my friend, we were driving in a truck and he said, so have you had a surgery, Stu? And I said, oh yeah, we were going to visit a friend in the hospital. And I said, oh yeah, I had, you know, for my hernia. And I said, how about you? And he says, oh yeah, I had shrapnel. So I'm like, why? You just can't say shrapnel and keep talking. So he kept on driving. I'm like, no, really, you have to tell me. So he actually had a grenade explode right next to him, and it nearly killed him. It was amazing. Within this memory of violence is an inspirational amount of grace and reconciliation. That was what makes Rwanda so incredible, is that all this stuff went on there, but they've moved past it into this amazing grace and reconciliation, the two words. So how do we get there? A few years ago, we were talking about going to Africa, and I heard that Janice Nickel worked for a company or an NGO called Wellspring. How many of you know Janice Nickel? Yeah, a lot of you know her. She's lovely. So I send an email off, janice@wellspringfoundation.com, see what happens. Next day, she sent an email back, said, you guys have to come talk to our CEO, Richard. And before we knew it, we had committed to going to Rwanda for a year until he told us we had to raise $40,000. The cynical side of me just laughed. Forget it. There's no way we're going to raise that kind of money. We wanted to raise it ourselves. We had to say, okay, fine, we'll start asking people, like it's going to work, right? I'm just so blown away by the amazing generosity of the people in our lives. Complete strangers would give us money. Kids would save birthday money and give it to us. We had a fantastic go-karting night where a bunch of us raised money, and Phil, Pastor Phil, I got to run into him at full speed in a go-kart. It was really fun. Bottom line is, we met our goal in February, and there's no way we could have done it without you guys. It was incredible. Thank you so much. So the first month there was overwhelming, fully overwhelming, but very positive. Rwandans are gracious and friendly, lovely people. I give you a perfect example of how a Rwandan person is like. In the evenings, I'd often go running, and I'd go around our neighborhood, and you know, I'm not super fit, and I'm getting old, so like 5K, I'm pushing my luck, right? And I'm running, and what'll happen is you'll run past a group of guys who had been working for 10 hours, and you'd run past them, I'd run by, and then I'd hear doo, 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 behind me, and I'm like, oh no, I'm going to get killed, you know? But then I realized, they just want to run with you. It's so cool. I don't know, I actually posted on my blog, I don't know if you saw it, but you know, you'd run along, and then you look behind, and you're like, and they would just run with you. They'd be wearing jeans and work boots and their t-shirt, maybe holding on to a machete. not great. It's okay. And they'd be running along, and they would run for a kilometer, and then they would just go their way, and they'd wave, and they'd say hi. Sometimes they'd run ahead of me, and they'd look back. Come on, old guy. Or you get chased by kids. It was fantastic. Yeah. The staff at Wellspring are so welcoming and incredible. And one thing that I learned is that Rwandans like touch. You'll be out in the street and you'll see men holding hands. And it's because they're just bonded and they're talking to each other and they're just holding hands. After a while, I'd be sitting down and all these Rwandan guys would come around me. And actually, you can see one of the teacher pictures up there. They would sit practically on top of you. And then, you know, Stephen, the administrator, he'd have his hand on my lap. Like, it felt really weird at first. And then after a while, I realized, this is pretty cool. I want to get this going here in Canada. Would guys be into that? No? All right, Jody, we'll do that. Oh, yeah. When Rwandans shake your hand, they'll hold on. And they won't let go. And here you're kind of like, let go. Here, there, they just hold your hand and they'll talk to you. And you make that connection. It's fantastic. I absolutely loved it. So we made friends with fantastic people. Our neighbors, we didn't really know them, but we didn't get to know the men that worked in their houses. They lived in these little spots in their house, about 6 feet by 10 feet long. And their family typically was about 2-3 hours away by bus in a small village. So they would take care of the house, and then during the day, they would sit on the side of the road. You can actually see the picture. It says, and plugging, just down from there. That's Atanas and Damasen, and another neighbor we ran into at the end. Every day, they'd be sitting there, and they would hang out and chat, and they'd ask you to come and sit with them and practice their English on you. It was fantastic. Being able to be even a very, very small part of their lives was an absolute privilege. It was an incredible experience for our family. And the fact that they had such a harrowing and horrible experience, and it's woven into every single part of their lives, just makes it all that much more powerful and beautiful. So, last little thing I'm going to talk about briefly is a fruit stand. I don't picture up there. No, we don't have a picture of the fruit stand. Occasionally I'd go shopping. We had a market and it was huge and psychotic, crazy, thousands of people in one small spot. But to buy fruit and vegetables, I would sometimes go to a very small market. And I went there for a few months, and actually my mom was out with us. And I would chat with the owner. His name is John Bosco. Super nice guy. And one day, my mom was sitting next to me in the car, and she said, "Stu, that man is standing by the window." And I looked, and he's standing there, John, and he's just, and I'm like, hey, and I'm rolling down, hey, John, what, you got a question? And he's like, so I know you work for Wellspring, you work with teachers. Would you like to come see my school? And I'm like, you got a school? He said, yeah, just up the road, that's my school. So I'm like, yeah, let's do it. So a few days later, my mom and I went there. It's an incredible story, and yet so typical of Rwandans. He wanted to educate the poor kids. So all around us were the mud houses that are very typical of Rwandans. And he sold his house. He took all of his money and bought a small plot of land. And then he started growing classrooms until now he has 90 kids. And he employs about 10 people. And I'm actually in the process of linking his school with my school in Langley. So we're going to have a haunted house at our school, and we're going to raise money. And all that money is going to go to John Bosco and his school, Mama Fascia for Kids. And the reason I'm telling you this is not just because it's pretty cool, but because before I went to Rwanda, you know, you get to World Vision and all these incredible things. But well, when you go and you get to actually see it on the ground, you realize that it's a very real thing and that it's very easy for all of us to be a part of it. It's very easy for us to all get involved. It's that first little step. If you ever do want to become a part of that, please, I would encourage you. Come talk to Deb and I. We would love to help people set up with that. So let me know. You know, that's all I've got to say. Lucky.
Hey.
So I'd like to call Rupert up, and he's going to have a word.
Taking after my dad, I also am quite short. When we went to Rwanda, I thought that when I went to the first day of school, I thought that I might not make a lot of friends and people wouldn't really, just kind of pay attention to me. But it turns out I was completely wrong. Everybody was very kind, and they didn't want to be mean to you, and they always wanted to just help you when you needed it, and they invited you kindly to hang out with you. It was very nice. I was really happy to figure out that everybody was so nice at school. At KIX, my school, it was an international school, and my class had 18 kids in it, and every single kid was from a different country. There were some from, well, everywhere. I was quite overwhelmed by how many people, how many different places there were, KIX was my first Christian school that I ever attended, and every day in the morning our teacher would ask us what some things that we want all of us to pray about, and there were some amazing things like people's grandpas riding across Africa on a bike, or Ebola, or horrible terrorist attacks like ISIS and a lot of our stuff, and we pray for that, and I thought it was quite amazing. One of the best friends I made, Martin, I made friends with that when, by accident, I found a praying mantis, and I was holding it, and it jumped onto his leg. And it scared him so much, and then I picked it off of him, and we talked for a tiny bit, and then somehow we became friends, and we got onto the topic of Batman. I have no idea how, but we started off with bugs, and it came off Batman. If any of you have an idea of how that happened, please tell me, because I'm still clueless. Okay. There's a lot of cool stuff there. A lot of like amazing bugs, like moths the size of your hand, or caterpillars that look fuzzy when really are little needles. We know a person who actually got a big caterpillar it looks like a big, regular caterpillar that you see here, but black and really fluffy looking. And the fluff is just big spines. And the little boy named Micah that we know got one in his shoe. And it was on a little hike in Rwanda, and he had it for about 2 hours in his foot, right? Yeah, about 2 hours in his foot. And you couldn't see the spines because they're so small, so the only way to do it, to get him out, was to get duct tape, put on wherever it stings, and rip it off the duct tape, which luckily I didn't have to do. There were hundreds of amazing bugs there, which fascinated me quite a bit. We always had to be careful with not letting food out and then leaving the house with food out because ants would come. And on the first day, that we stayed in our main house that we lived in Rwanda, we spilled some pineapple juice, and we went for an hour. We came back, and then instead of a big splash on the ground, we saw a big black splash on the ground, and it turned out to be thousands of ants in the exact shape of the splash. Me and my sister thought of an idea where we could get some pineapple juice, make a smiley face out of it, and see if the ants would make a smiley face. Though that never was accomplished. In Rwanda, cockroaches and millipedes. Millipedes, if anybody knows who they are, but if anybody doesn't, they're pretty much hard worms that are black and have a bunch of thousands of little legs. And we could find cockroaches and millipedes in our bathrooms, shower stalls, rooms, and I got so fond of millipedes, I actually put them in my cupboard. They're about finger long. My finger's long, maybe not my dad's. But in Uganda, when we went to see a national park, we flipped over some rocks, and there are millipedes about this long. and a picture just on the where the big moth is under that. This black thing I put over the top of my lip is a millipede. And I learned from a person when we were first visiting in Rwanda that millipedes poop when they're frightened, and the poop can actually agitate your skin quite a bit, and it makes you itch a lot. Luckily, and I think that still happens a tiny bit right now. Okay. but just all in all, everything was it was amazing. I wouldn't miss any. Everything was worth it except for the plane ride. But I would want to talk more and more, but my sister has a talk which I actually would want to miss. But oh, whatever. but thank you so much for letting me talk. And yeah.
Okay, so like Rio, I could be talking for like hours and hours, but I chose two main experiences and stories to talk about. Okay, so first of all is our Odette. Odette is, where is she? The top picture under the thing that says Fiat, with me and my brother standing, she's in between us. Odette was our house help. So when we first got to Rwanda, one of the guys from Wellspring, they told us, oh, you should probably get a house help. And we thought, we need, like, a maid? Like, do we really need that? Like, that seems like a higher class thing. Do we really need that? So we learned that, everyone has a house help. Like, the house helpers have house helpers. It's not a matter of class. It's just a matter of giving someone a job, right? So we got Odette, and we became such good friends with her. We went to her village, and we met her daughter. Well, she had gotten electricity for the first time in her whole life, and she'd gotten like one light bulb in her house. And the person who had put up the electricity booth, they hadn't put in a roof over it, and it rains a lot in Rwanda, right? So we went over to her house, and my dad put in a big metal I think there's a picture of it there. Yeah, you see on the side of his house, of the red house. So she lives in just a little clay house with her and her daughter, and I think her sister. And her husband is away doing police training, so it's about a two-hour drive from where they live. So he's only home. They only see him once or twice a year. So Odette lives with her daughter, Fiete. They've come over to our house a couple times, and it's fascinating seeing Fiete, the little daughter. The first time we saw her, she was so afraid of us. She came up, and she was in this little cute little white dress, and she wouldn't go near us. She was so afraid of us. She didn't speak any English. But she came over to our house. And after a little while, we played with her. We tossed a ball back and forth. And then she was screaming and laughing, and she taught us a little dance around the table, and very cute. But so Fiete goes to a school where she's starting to learn English. There's a video we want to play of her singing in our car about her education. So if we can play that.
I am a teacher, Tibos, and education. Can I miss you, said education. I am a Nazi, Tibos, and education. I am a Nazi, Tibos, and education.
She doesn't really speak English. We were trying to decipher what her words meant. We were talking to her mom, trying to say, is this what she's saying? Because the words that were up on the screen, they might not be the right words. We're just kind of guessing. So we had the opportunity to send Fiete to school. We sent her to the Wellspring Academy that my parents were working at. So we've like this. It's amazing. We've helped pay for her school, for her school life, for her kindergarten to grade 12, and she's very excited to go. The only thing she's not excited about, though, is that she thought originally that her teacher would be Teacher Debbie. So we had to slowly ease it on her that she wasn't going to be her teacher. She's very cute. She thinks that when she first came over to our house, when we first met her, afterward her mom Odette had told us that she had been calling us her Mzungus. Mzungu is the word for, in Rwanda, it's like a white person, so it's us, right? So everyone will say, "Oh, look at Mzungu." So Fiete had labeled us her Mzungu. So we were driving her home, and it was along a very bumpy road, and all the kids were jumping in the back of our pickup truck. So they were all jumping, they were waving and smiling at us. And Fiete, in the back of the car, we had no idea what she was saying. We couldn't understand, but her mother had been telling us that she was yelling, "No, go away, these are my Mzungus, you cannot take my Mzungus." Okay. So that's Odette and Fiete. Odette, so wonderful. She helped us so much. Like, now looking back on it, I don't think we could have survived without her, really. Okay, so the other story I want to talk to you about is in Chuti. You can see it on the other side. So our class had put together a bake sale, and we had fundraised to go to the school in the Chuti orphanage. So our school also, like, had different classes bringing, like, toilet paper and flour and, like, little things of milk and stuff like that. So we brought it over to this orphanage, and I got to go with a couple of my classmates go to see this orphanage. So the kids there are amazing. There's a couple of kids who were lying on the floor. They weren't able to move. They were crunched up and couldn't move. You can see on the corner there, with a boy who's sitting up, you can see just out of the corner, a kid who's on the floor and won't probably, almost probably never be able to move and walk again. We were trying not to take pictures, because if we just took a picture of the really disabled kids, it's like, that's kind of disrespectful, right? So my mom tried to just take pictures out of the corner so you guys could see it. Another girl, her name is Kareza. She can see at the top, I'm walking with her, holding her hand. She's 4 years old, and she learned to walk 2 weeks before this picture was taken. She could not walk before that. So we would walk her, hold her hand, and walk her around, and every so often she would stop, and I would bend down, and she'd put her hands on my knee and just smile up at me. And just, like, be panting and tired from walking, and just keep smiling. She was smiling the entire time. She was so happy. Another boy, you can see I'm holding her with the girl sitting next to me. He is about 2 years old. He looks a lot younger, and he was found on the side of the road like 1 or 2 days before. So yeah, the kids are like so amazing, and we would walk them around the little courtyard thing that they had, and like, so lots of them were in wheelchairs, and you know, it was very cool. So just to like kind of wrap it up, I guess it's kind of a conclusion. Something I noticed, if you, like, you've got the situations of Odette and Fiete and then the kids at the Institute Orphanage, you can see how we think about such little problems. When I came back, I really noticed this, like, we are so concerned about such little things, like the financial stuff and just little details, right? And then you go to Rwanda and you see what the people there are dealing with and what their problems are, and it's just like, oh, why are we worried about that again? So, yeah. Thank you.
Excellent. Something, Annie, I think we are trying to rush through so we don't keep you too long, but something Annie was going to mention that's worth noting is that we would probably have one of those kids here with us right now if Rwanda had its doors open for international adoptions. But actually, we really see it as a good thing that they don't. They are very committed as a country to giving homes to their orphaned children, tracking down family members and finding homes for them. So really the only orphanages that are left there are special needs orphanages, and that was the one that Annie had visited.
So my part of our Rwanda story, I'm just going to talk to you about how this is my impression and what this made me feel so excited about our time, about how I see God is working in Rwanda, or how he works in general, my impressions from the last year, and who he uses. So first of all, Stuart kind of gave you quickly a quick look at how our getting there process. And something from the very beginning that struck me was what happened inside of my heart, and I know Stuart's too, that made us end up in Rwanda. It felt like all of a sudden there was this real interest in Rwanda, and we would hear little things about how they were little phrases about how they are raising up a new generation of leaders. We would hear talk about the reconciliation process that was happening there. There was something that, though, about that was just all of a sudden became so interesting to me. And as I reflect back now, I can really see, because this is a growing process for me, to know how God moves in me and how he nudges me to do things. And one of my markers now that I can really realize that this is God moving in me is when an interest or a passion about something comes in to my head that there's no reason that should be there. And what I'm realizing more and more is of how God works is usually that passion, or always what I'm experiencing, comes with a sense of love for the people for the people who he's put in your mind. So right away, when we started hearing about Rwanda, I just had this feeling of, oh my goodness, this is incredible! Like the potential of what they've come through as a country, what we can see, what we know for. Like how much they've progressed. They have moved from the poorest country, I think the poorest country at one point, to they are quickly pulling themselves out of poverty and have worked very, very hard to do that under really good leadership in their country. But also the story that goes along with that of coming through a genocide where they were killing each other to now under the new government in their reconciliation process, it's imposed on them that they are to see themselves as one Rwanda. You don't say Tutsi or Hutu anymore. They are to see themselves as one. And so part of the excitement of us going in was feeling like, for me, was, how is this happening? Because this has huge applications. If a country or if people can reconcile with each other who have killed each other, and we saw this like everywhere you go in our schools, there would be, you know, that there are people working together whose families have killed each other, you know, in this last generation, or in our generation. And so we were fascinated of how is that working, because it seems like the implications for the rest of the world, and especially when what we were hearing is this is that Wellspring Academy, who we joined up with, is raising up this new generation of servant leaders, and their motto is to bless these servant leaders will bless Rwanda and bless the world. And so when I heard that, I just thought, well, of course, like it just felt like an of course picture in my head. And I realize now that this isn't an of course picture for everybody who hears it, but at the time I thought, well, probably everybody would see this, that there is something about the circumstance of these kids who are being raised up to be new leaders in Rwanda that will make them incredible leaders in our world if they can get it right, you know, if they can actually get this reconciliation process right, if it works out. Those kids will be amazing world leaders. So I went with this excitement of feeling like, I am so excited to be part of this. Now, I recognize now, looking back, that's the motto in lots of places, but it's not something that is necessarily rooted in people's hearts. So that was really exciting for me to be able to work with This is what we ended up actually doing mostly. We Stuart and I went thinking that I was going to be working with the primary literacy and Stuart would be working with the senior technology department. And we ended up working mostly probably the last 6 months with the administrators of the school because our goal was to help them to move towards that vision of raising up meeting their motto of raising up a new generation of servant-minded leaders. So our school that we taught at, Wellspring Academy, is a private school, and they have when they were setting up the school, their aim was to have 20% of their students funded by the other 80%. So the kids who are there are from middle to affluent families in Rwanda, for sure. And it's an expensive school by Rwandan standards to go to. In the last years before Stuart and I went to Rwanda, they had implemented the teachers had and staff had been working on implementing an international curriculum, and that had taken off a lot of their focus. Which was a good thing for their school, but it had done things like raised fees and it had made it hard for them to meet that goal of having 20% of the kids who are coming to the school funded by the rest of the families. It actually was not happening at all. So that was one of the things that I had the privilege of being able to help refocus them with towards the end, and working with what ended up happening is, and this is how I feel very excited about what's being revealed to me of who God uses. I talked to the kids at dismissal about the power of small, and I am not a Bible reading person at all. I have not been somebody who has studied my Bible, but I in the year in Rwanda, I was really impacted by like a desire to want to start doing that. First of all, and I started to like come across verses that all of a sudden, like I could still not tell you where they're found. That's not my strength, but I have some of them here. But coming across verses that I knew, like it just felt like there's this verse that talks about the verse that talks about how God will write. Let me see if I have it. Jeremiah 31:33. It says, I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And no longer shall each one teach his neighbor or brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me. And so I had this feeling, as I was reading verses, and they would sort of come alive in my head, which, for those of you who know me, probably know that's not, I'm not like that kind of a Christian-y person, but that feeling of a verse coming alive in my head and just being like, yes, this is exactly what I'm wanting these people to know right now. This is what I want you to know. This is what I want you to feel, was such an amazing thing. And so as I started to work with the administrators and then the grade 11 students, the student council, we got to set that up when we were with them. What I was being put on my heart over and over again was that this generation of kids, what is going to make them effective leaders for their country and for the world is not going to be their education. It's not going to be how well they learn how to learn. It's going to come down to the top two rules of being a Christ follower. We kind of looked at that quite a bit, and we came up with this. There's a little graphic up there, I think, that's got the God in me, and it's this picture of a guy going like this. But this picture, I feel like God like put it on my heart over and over and over again. Nothing else matters. This is what you need to be telling your students and the staff. Yes, an education is what is going to make it so that these kids can rise out of their poverty and their circumstances, but what will make them the only thing that will make them of any use to God and in kingdom building purposes is that it's God in them that is doing things. And I felt that myself this year. So my story is from my story in this is I feel like God really, really clearly put that on me, that I was so surprised, and Stuart and I both felt this. We have no experience working with administrators. I have a staff of two or three that I work with, but I would absolutely be someone that shies away from giving bold advice on anything. But I just felt really strongly this year that there's a reason for God choosing the people he chooses. Because maybe if I had somebody, if I was a leader, if I had leadership training and I knew how to train leaders, maybe I could have chalked up the wisdom that was coming into my head to give as my own learned wisdom. But the way that God rolled it out in my life, there was nothing. The things that he was putting in my head, they seemed so simple and clear to me. And they were simple and clear, because I think God's plan always is so simple. But I know they were not from anything that I had learned in school. I know they were right from God. And so this is what I felt wanted to communicate with the kids. So I had two verses that I went over and over again this year. And one is Jeremiah 9:23. Let not the wise man boast in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man boast in his might. Let not the rich man boast in his riches. But let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who practices steadfast love. So that sticks in my head and still now does, because it was so humbling this year to feel like any area that we were really impactful in, or that when I wouldn't say we, or that God was able to be impactful in through us this year, was nothing to do with anything we had ever learned. Like, we felt like we were coming with these skills to be able to bring, you know, like a literacy background and a technology education background. But really, the big things that happened were things that were given to us, because we just were able to be in a position to be open to take them. And the feeling of that, of what it feels like for me, inside of me, to have that feeling is so different than I ever thought it would be. Like, I always thought to be used by God to be a missionary would be, you would have to be stepping outside of your comfort zone, and that you would be constantly being met by challenges, which we were. But what surprised me was how exciting it is. Like, I feel now like there is no feeling in the world that's better than having a moment of being like, oh my goodness, that is absolutely God that is leading me to do this. And I know that feeling now definitively inside of me, to know what that feels like. And it's exciting. And it's like nothing else. And I'm so excited I got to do that this year. So the other verse that was in my head a lot was just the beginning of Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak in the tongue of men and of angels but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers, understanding all mysteries and knowledge, and if I have faith so as to move mountains but I have not love, I am nothing. And this was something that I felt really like I had no place for who I was to actually be talking to these people who had come through what they had come through, to be reminding them, okay, you know what, actually, yeah, you can be getting a great education and you can be, you know, but if you don't have love, any of that wisdom that you have, in God's eyes, what he tells us will amount to nothing. If you don't have God in you driving what you're doing, driving what the education that you've got, if he's not at the root of how you use that, and if it's not God's love in you that's driving those things, then your efforts account to nothing in kingdom purposes. So that just, to me, this year has just also really hit me that I totally get that. And it was so exciting to be able to have amazing conversations with our administrators and the youth that we were working with, and to be able to communicate to them another crazy moment was just talking to these grade 11 students and saying, sharing with them this picture that I had had before I had come, that there's something about their circumstances and who they are at this point in history and being raised up that is not just going to be, because they hear all the time in Rwanda that they are the promise of their generation for changing Rwanda and for bringing up Rwanda. But they were surprised to hear, and I was surprised that they hadn't heard this before, the implications of what their leadership could have within the world. And it was exciting for me to be able to share what I think is that vision of what that could look like. So we're going to end with a video. The kids that I worked with, the grade 11 students, they do not have a culture. They have a culture of it's mandated that they bring survivors into their families. So you have lots of families who have extra siblings in there, but it is not always out of a love to want to pull people in. So that also reflects in their culture. They don't do like, there's people outside of the Wellspring Academy area and villages that are total in poverty, and it doesn't cross the minds of the families there to do fundraising efforts or to help build up the schools outside. That's not a culture. It's still very much Western money coming in to help build up around. So there was a really cool thing that happened at the end of the year, and I'm just quickly going to tell you, there's a picture up here of a girl. Three kind of cool stories came together. Right on the right-hand side, the girl in the green shirt, her name is Winnie, and she is one of our Wellspring students, incredibly shy, incredibly humble, but we could recognize in her amazing leadership potential. She did not go out for our student council. We tried to force her to and say, please, please do it, and she was like, no, I'm not a leader. And she ended up, we were able to pull her in to be the secretary of the council. That is one story. Another story I just want to quickly pull in is Nicholas and Elsie Hitamana, and they are above the picture of the church there at the bottom. They are an incredible couple who are survivors who we had the privilege to become friends with. They fled the country in 94. Nicholas was a Hutu, and Elsie was a Tutsi. All of her family were killed. They had this big, beautiful village that they lived in. And part of their process, reconciliation process, was in incredible stories of forgiveness. But as Elsie shares this, when she came back to find her family, went back to her family village, the sort of a 10-year later story, they had the whole village was now had families in it that were being raised of Hutu families who had been a part of the genocide of her family or the killing of her family. So she knew that she struggled so much with forgiveness, but I'm just going to read to you quickly a little quote from her, and then I'm going to wrap up. Is my phone down there? So what they have done is they have gone back into this village, and they have reconciled with the people in that village, and now have started. They built a church there, and they have heard desire. They've started a little school there, and I'm just going to read to you quickly a quote around Elsie talking about her story. So she says, "My story, along with my family who perished in the genocide, left me with an understanding of the word darkness and then great light. Both darkness and light can be on our way, and it is up to us to choose one and live in it, work in it, invest in it, and die in it. And for me, I have chosen the light that comes from the giver of life, knowing that my life is a second chance. So many of my family can no longer be asked for advice because they have finished their race, and I think they are where I can not hear them or speak to them or see them coming, and I must continue my race like they did until I finish it. I forgive you are words that have been a shortcut to my freedom. This forgiveness was given to me from no one else but the creator of humankind, because he knew that it would create light and darkness. And in my weakness and exhaustion, I said, Lord, I want to give you back my right of judgment and make you the judge for my people. They are yours and my life is yours, but I'm tired with the things that I must understand. And since I can do nothing to help my family, I can see that I am losing the case. And I clearly heard him say this,
forgive them because they didn't know what they were doing. But me, I know, and they are mine too. I know them all, and I love them. So she goes on to say how she chose to forgive them and has gone on now. So now she has this preschool. You'll get to see a little video of this in a second. And the kids in her preschool are the families of these people who had slaughtered her own family. And she loves them. And she will say to you that love, it was a gift because it didn't come out of her works of an effort to try and get herself to love. It wasn't a practice thing. It just came as an instant gift. And I think I'm so inspired by how, like, God can do things like that in us, take horrible things and replace it with this unimaginable love. So I just want to tie Elsie's story quickly together with Winnie. So at the end of the year, Winnie had come forward with this idea. They have a memorial period at the end of during the 100 days of genocide. They have this memorial time. And Winnie had come forward with this idea that maybe they as a school could actually try and do something as youth to commemorate the genocide and to be able to help sort of widows and orphans, people around them, which is a very new thing that is kind of unheard of for a youth in Rwanda. Very, yeah, cool. And we had been praying that this would happen. And so here, I'm going to show you a little video and we'll end with this. But this was the bringing together of Elsie's school. So her school is about 2 hours away and they have nothing there. And what the Wellspring students have now taken on as a heart to reach their communities. And I think after this, we are going to leave the stage and let you go. So thank you so much. Pledge today, but if you, because that was made for the families at Wellspring, but if you would like to become part of what is happening in Elsie's school there, please come and chat to us. We would love to connect with you. Thank you.